From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. The 19th century abolitionist John Brown has been called many things, a martyr, a prophet, and a terrorist. He didn't hesitate to employ savage violence in his crusade against slavery. But biographer David Reynolds says Brown's extremism helped to frame the issue of slavery for a divided nation and hastened the outbreak of the Civil War. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Reynolds about the life and legacy of John Brown. Also, The X-Files and Beyond, a conversation with actor David Duchovny. He's best known as Agent Fox Mulder on The X-Files. Now he's written and directed a new film, House of D. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. Americans have thought a lot about terrorism in the last few years, and my guest David Reynolds believes we can learn a few things by examining the life of a famous 19th century terrorist, abolitionist John Brown. Brown is mostly remembered for his 1859 raid on Harper's Ferry, for which he was hanged. But 3 years before that, Brown led a raid in Kansas in which his followers slaughtered 5 unarmed settlers as part of his crusade to rid the nation of slavery. He was a well-known figure among Eastern intellectuals of his day, some of whom helped finance his plans for a guerrilla war in the South to free slaves. Reynolds sees Brown as a fanatic in pursuit of a just cause and believes his extremism sharpened the issue of slavery for Americans and hastened the outbreak of the Civil War. David Reynolds is a professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College of the City University of New York. His book is called John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. Brown became an anti-slavery activist late in his life. Before that, he was a tanner by trade who had a series of failed business ventures. He fathered 20 children in 2 marriages and was deeply religious. Reynolds says John Brown's views on racial equality differed from those of other abolitionists.
There were many very, very noble abolitionists of his period who hated slavery, who devoted their lives to ending slavery. However, virtually all of them retained the racist views of their era. It was an era in which blacks were considered to be innately inferior to whites. And it was surprising and a little bit sad that even Abraham Lincoln believed that blacks and whites could never live together in America. And therefore, Lincoln was a colonizationist who believed that once emancipated, blacks should be shipped out of America. And Thomas Jefferson was the same way. And so many of the abolitionists shared this racism at the same time that they loathed slavery. John Brown was very different. His parents integrated blacks into their household. They took in fugitive slaves. John Brown became very active on the Underground Railroad. And not only that, but he chose to live in North Elba, New York, which was a community of African Americans in upstate New York. Not only fraternized with them and helped them with their farming, but would quite often shock white visitors by inviting them to his table and treating them on exactly the same terms as anybody else.
John Brown is most remembered for the raid on Harper's Ferry, which ended his life. But there was this remarkable event in Kansas in 1856, known as the Pottawatomie Massacre, in which Brown essentially led in the slaughter of 5 unarmed settlers. Let's talk about this. What were the conditions in Kansas at the time? John Brown was there living with 3 sons, right?
Yes, he was there fighting slavery. What was happening was that Kansas was in a state of transition. The question was it going to become a slave state, or was it going to become a free state? And what was happening is that it was holding state elections, but they were being largely determined by pro-slavery people from nearby Missouri who would come over in drunken hordes armed with Bowie knives and terrorize the polling booths, take over the polling booths, and elect pro-slavery legislators in Kansas. And it was a horribly corrupt situation, and John Brown and a few other abolitionists went out there to fight this. And eventually Kansas became a free state, but there was a period of transition when there was quite a lot of violence.
We're not just talking about election tampering. There were murders here, right? A lot of them.
Yeah, there were murders, and some people who pointed John Brown say, oh, he was a horrible murderer. It was true that he dragged 5 pro-slavery citizens at midnight out of their beds and murdered them with swords. It was a horrible situation. However, that act is very rarely placed in context. We have to realize that between 1855 and 1858, 3/4 of the deaths were anti-slavery citizens, were people that opposed slavery. They were killed by pro-slavery people. And among those deaths, 28 were murders. So in other words, there were 28 anti-slavery people murdered and only 8 pro-slavery people, 5 of whom John Brown murdered. So it's possible to say that to defend John Brown not only on those terms, but also in the sense that he viewed slavery itself as a state of war. Slavery for him was a state of war against African Americans. That was his view of slavery.
So John Brown decides that action will be taken and vengeance will be inflicted upon the pro-slavery criminals
yes.
in Kansas. Tell us about the raid. What did he do exactly?
What happened was that there was something called the so-called Law and Order Party, which was a pro-slavery party in Kansas, and there were five members of this party that a couple of them had bragged, well, pretty soon we're going to wipe out all the abolitionists in Kansas. We're going to strew Kansas with their corpses. And this got to John Brown, and among the other triggers, this is another thing that made him take the action that he did. He gathered eight people, including a couple of his own sons. And at midnight, he had some swords, some broadswords. He went to the cabins of these five people. Actually, it was a father and two sons in one cabin. That was the Doyle family. Then he went on to another cabin and took out a couple of other men and murdered them.
In some cases with wives weeping and protesting, right?
Yeah, the first cabin, James Doyle, his wife Mahala. She said, you know, I told you, James, you know, something bad was going to happen. And James Doyle said, "Hush, mother." And of course, at the time, you know, John Brown came in and said, you know, I hereby arrest you in the name of the Northern Party, the anti-slavery, and the Northern Army, and. At the time, I don't think Doyle or anyone believed that he was going to be immediately executed, but he was taken outside with two of his sons and was murdered while the wife and the other children were inside the cabin. You know, it's a horrible kind of situation. On the other hand, so was you know, several centuries of slavery, and so was what was happening in Kansas at the time with those 28 murders committed by pro-slavery people. There was a reason it was called Bleeding Kansas.
You know, 80 years after John Brown took the militant actions he did, Gandhi in India used a strategy of nonviolence in resisting the British. And, you know, the pacifist critique of the kind of killings that Brown and his followers undertook would be that once you commit to this kind of violence, you in effect lose some of the humanity which drove you to embrace the noble cause you were seeking to advance. And I'm wondering, how did members of John Brown's party react to the carnage that they inflicted that night?
Well, his own sons were devastated. They, you know, had some of them had mental problems after that. Some of his followers were, they said that there can be no more work such as this. This is just too much for us. And John Brown himself even had ambivalent feelings about it, although ultimately he kind of reconciled himself with it. But, you know, we have to, you mentioned Gandhi and so forth. What's interesting is someone like Henry David Thoreau, who introduced the idea of civil disobedience that was used later by Gandhi and by Martin Luther King, and himself had been the greatest exponent of passive resistance in the 19th century because he was sent to jail for refusing to pay a tax to a pro-slavery government, the United States government. He was sent to jail for that, and he wrote Civil Disobedience, and this influenced Martin Luther King and Gandhi. But he became the great champion of John Brown in full knowledge of Pottawatomi and Harper's Ferry and all of John Brown's violence. Why? Because slavery at that moment it seemed to be cemented forever in place. Lincoln, before the Civil War, said, well, it'll probably take 100 years, slavery will someday leave. People were saying 50, 80, 100 years slavery would remain. Why? Because there were a series of laws, the Fugitive Slave Law, the Kansas-Nebraska Act, and then the Dred Scott decision by the Supreme Court, that increasingly seemed to put slavery in place for good. So it wasn't quite a Gandhi situation. This was a situation where action had to be taken. Unfortunately, violent action had to be taken to attempt to dislodge slavery.
My guest is critic and cultural historian David Reynolds. His new book is John Brown, Abolitionist. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're back with David Reynolds. He's a critic and cultural historian. His new book is called John Brown, Abolitionist. Well, David Reynolds, while John Brown was touring the East and raising money among intellectual elites, he was assembling an army in Iowa for a plan he had developed to attack an arsenal and open up a guerrilla war to liberate slaves throughout the South. He's been described as crazy, but do you think the plan actually was somewhat rational? Tell us, what exactly was the idea? What was the plan?
His idea was to raid a certain slave area, turned out to be Harper's Ferry, Virginia, a slave region, liberate slaves, and with the liberated blacks to flee into the mountains. The Appalachian Mountains ran, well, really all the way from the north deep into the south, and then scatter groups of both whites and blacks along the mountain range, and then periodically make raids of plantations, liberate more slaves, assemble a rather large colony of blacks in the mountains, large and yet dispersed. And John Brown knew the mountains quite well because he'd been a surveyor and actually had gone into Virginia, and he knew a lot of the crags and so forth. And eventually he hoped to, through his the worst fear of the South was slave rebellion, slave insurrection. And he wanted to cultivate this fear, this terror. He used the word terror to make this terror grow, increase to such a degree that the South would come to want to compromise with the North on the slavery issue. To say, you know what, this is becoming unmanageable down here. You know, we're just, these slave rebellions are breaking out, and okay, we'll compromise. That was his goal. And some people have said that he was crazy. I think it was a very smart idea because if we look at modern times, at bin Laden in the mountains, there are examples, or the Afghan guerrillas against the huge Soviet army and so forth in the 70s and 80s, and you know, you could give examples from modern times of people who have used mountainous territory to evade much, much superior forces. And John Brown said, "Let them try to pursue me in the mountains. Go ahead." And I think that if he had actually done what he said he was going to do, if he had managed to get away from Harper's Ferry. I mean, I don't know if he could have gotten rid of slavery like that, but certainly he could have waged a campaign of terror in the South that would have had a very disturbing effect.
So he develops this plan, which involved taking a military arsenal and armory at Harper's Ferry, Virginia, which is on a peninsula between two rivers. And he would have others go in the countryside and liberate slaves, and then they would have the arms and the slaves and then retreat to the mountains to build a guerrilla war. Now, it began smoothly. I mean, they took the two bridges into the armory, and took the guards hostage relatively easily. And also, his Confederates went through the countryside, liberated some slaves, brought their masters in as hostages. Yeah. It all seemed to be going to plan. Why did it bog down?
I believe the reason it bogged down was that the reaction by the slaves was not quite what John Brown had expected. He thought that when he made his strike, the bees would hive, as he said, the bees would hive, that suddenly there would be the slaves would be so happy And they would rush to his side, and then he would just, you know, take his hostages, go into the mountains, and begin his campaign of terror against slavery. What happened was a lot of the slaves were shocked. They were bewildered. They were confused. And one could say, well, why didn't, you know, obviously slaves wanted to be free. Obviously. Innately, they wanted to be. Why didn't they suddenly say, okay, let's go join John Brown? My view of it is that it's almost as though a Martian showed up. I mean, to them, the idea of a white person showing up at midnight and saying, you're free, a white person in the company, because John Brown had five black soldiers as well, in the company of blacks showing up and saying, you're free, it was just a completely strange and bizarre thing for these enslaved blacks. And some of them did fight with John Brown and joined him willingly. Others were just basically confused, and they had been so oppressed and so degraded for so many years that it was hard for them to suddenly identify with this person who shows up out of the blue at you know, late at night and says, you're free. So John Brown really had this kind of idealistic vision of suddenly this whole army of black warriors rushing to his side. And when that did not happen, he stalled. He delayed. He kind of kept waiting for it to happen. And it was really the delay that caused the defeat of his plans, because he waited and waited. Finally, a train went through and the news spread. And pretty soon the federal troops were there by noon the next day. The local militia was out. And he was cornered. He was trapped by that time.
So Brown and his followers were cornered in this armory.
Yes.
You know, confronted by local militia and eventually federal troops. It did not end mm-hmm. peacefully. What happened?
Well, what happened is that John Brown, as I said, stalled. The word spread. Finally, from Washington, Robert E. Lee came with federal troops. And John Brown eventually, I mean, there was a lot of violence. Several of his men were either shot down. His own son, two of his own sons died, very long, painful deaths. One was shot in the bowels and, you know, died over the course of 16 hours right by John Brown's side. And ultimately what happened is that John Brown and a few of his remaining followers were trapped inside the fire engine house at Harper's Ferry, which later became known as John Brown's Fort. And Robert E. Lee sent some troops that battered down the doors of the fort and came in, killed a couple of people. And one person, one soldier, made several thrusts at John Brown with his sword, and John Brown should have died then, because he was stabbed in the stomach and he was stabbed in the head several times. But the person who stabbed him had accidentally picked up his dress saber, his dress sword, which is like a sort of a phony sword, and kept on stabbing John Brown, but instead of his military saber. Military saber would have just instantly killed John Brown. But just in the rush that morning, he picked up his dress sword. And as a result, John Brown lived. And that's the only reason why John Brown had effect on American history, because what happened is that he lived and he talked, and the nation watched him talk and act nobly during his imprisonment.
You conclude that John Brown's raid had enormous impact on slavery, really because of the way John Brown behaved during it and after it at his trial.
Yes.
And the way those events were perceived. I mean, how was John Brown remembered or even mythologized, you know, by both sides in the conflict over slavery after the raid?
Because he lived, the legend of John Brown grew. And the reason it grew is the way he behaved during his imprisonment and trial. He didn't go. Some of his backers in the North went crazy. One was overwhelmed with guilt and ended up in a lunatic asylum and so forth. And others fled the country. But John Brown himself remained very strong, and throughout his entire trial, and at the very end, he made a statement of less than 250 words that Emerson said was as great as the Gettysburg Address. It was just a statement of his anti-slavery views. And as a result, he slowly gained favor in the North. At first, virtually all the Northerners said, "Who is this strange guy who attacked the South?" They basically they kind of admired his anti-slavery views, but they really dissociated themselves from him. But then Thoreau and Emerson and a few others said, "Now wait a minute here. This guy is Thoreau and Emerson put him virtually on the same level of Jesus Christ, very literally, because Emerson said, John Brown will make the gallows as glorious as the cross. And this statement by Emerson, who had a lot of cultural clout, shot throughout America like a ricocheting bullet, and it polarized the country. And the South, which had formerly praised John Brown's character, of course, as I said, they always hated him, but they praised his character, suddenly demonized him. And suddenly John Brown was not only evil, but also representative of basically what was going on in the North. So suddenly John Brown became an incredibly polarizing figure, a symbol, something much larger than, let's say, Ruby Ridge or Oklahoma City have become in modern times. He became a huge, tremendous symbol for both the North and for the South.
Well, David Reynolds, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
David Reynolds is a professor of English and American Studies at the Graduate Center and Baruch College of the City University of New York. His new book is John Brown, Abolitionist, The Man Who Killed Slavery, Sparked the Civil War, and Ceded Civil Rights. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Virginia Woolf's long-neglected novel, Night and Day, in the Barnes & Noble Classic Series, available in stores and at bn.com. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Jeep, introducing the trail-rated Jeep Liberty CRD with next-generation diesel technology, emissions and performance capabilities at jeep.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how a former PhD candidate in English at Yale becomes a Hollywood hunk. A conversation with actor David Duchovny about acting, The X-Files, and his new film, House of D. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. David Duchovny has had his share of success in Hollywood, but he didn't follow a typical route getting there. After growing up in New York and attending a prep school on scholarship, he graduated from Princeton and was getting a PhD in English at Yale before deciding to move to California and pursue acting. After minor parts in several movies, Duchovny found a role that seemed to fit him perfectly in a TV series that became one of the breakout hits of the 90s. In 9 seasons on The X-Files, Duchovny played FBI agent Fox Mulder, investigating supernatural happenings and government cover-ups with his partner Dana Scully, played by Gillian Anderson. The role made Duchovny a star. Since leaving the series 5 years ago, Duchovny has made guest appearances in other TV shows and has starred in several films, including Evolution, Playing God, and Return to Me. Now Duchovny has written and directed his first feature film. It's called House of D, and it's a coming-of-age story about a 13-year-old boy growing up in New York in the 70s. Here's a scene from the film in which the boy, Tommy Warshaw, played by Anton Yelton, is talking to his mom, played by Taya Leone, about some problems he's having at school.
Mom. Listen, I really can't go back to that school anymore.
St. Andrews, what are you talking about?
We have to move. I did something bad. I said something, and they hate me there, and the girls really, really don't like me.
What are you doing with girls?
That's not the point, Mom. The point is that we have to find another school.
Now, don't tell me what the point is, Tommy. Your scholarship is the point, and getting into a good college is the point. Girls are beside the point. Jesus, Tommy. What are you trying to do to me?
I'm not trying to do anything to you, Mom. Forget it, okay?
You tell me you're gonna piss away your scholarship because of girls, I'm not gonna forget it. What am I working for, slaving away for you every day?
Forget this!
Tommy, where are you going?
Out.
Out where?
Out. Out.
Go on. Run away just like your father.
He didn't run away, Mom. He died.
Well, David Duchovny, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
This new film of yours, House of D, is, I guess, in part about a coming-of-age crisis involving a 13-year-old kid growing up in New York whose mom, played by your wife, Taya Leone, is struggling with the death of her husband. You grew up in New York. Your parents split up when you were, I guess, 12 or so. How much of this character in this film is autobiographical?
Well, mostly what's autobiographical in this film are superficial details of time and place, because I grew up in the village at that time. So when it came time to write it, I wanted to write a universal coming-of-age story, really, because my particular life story is not dramatic, and I didn't think it would reach out to anybody, really. So I thought that in order to be universal, I would actually be as specific as I could and try to make the time and the place come alive.
Is there any particular directing style that you were influenced by? What do you like on a set?
I think the best thing that I can do as a director, and the best thing a director can do for me as an actor, is make clear to me what the tone of the film is. And the tone of this film is kind of a mix of reality and fable. And in that, I was instructing the actors to try and exist on both worlds so that when it was funny, and I think that the movie is often funny, we didn't stretch the tone so much as to become ridiculous, so that when it came time for the tragedy of the film or the tear-jerking part of the film, that it wouldn't break at that point. So as a director, I just try and give... I try and inform the actors what kind of a movie they're appearing in, so they all appear in the same movie. And hell for an actor is when he sees a film and he realizes he was acting in a different film from everybody else.
Have you had that experience as an actor?
Oh, of course. I think every actor has. And, it's really not the actor's fault in that case. In that case, it's always the director's fault, I think.
You of course, are known to most of America as Agent Mulder from The X-Files, which, you know, became an incredibly successful show. It was, I think, called by one writer in the New York Times the defining series of the 90s. And it developed a cult following of sorts. And I wonder if you, feared that you might forever be associated with this. You might become, a Leonard Nimoy, who we always expect to be a Vulcan with pointed ears somehow.
I never really did. I mean, I think that I don't want to compare us to Star Trek, but I think what separates the two shows is Star Trek was somewhat campy, I guess. And The X-Files always seemed to me kind of cinematic or filmic, and the drama realistic. And therefore, I thought that, playing a character is playing a character, even though I'm playing him every day for 8-9 years. And that eventually, after the iconic significance of that character fades away in the public memory, then I'll be allowed to move on. And if I'm not, it's mostly my fault for not working harder and for not being more imaginative. And if I'm not there, it's just testament to the power and the quality of the show.
Well, you know, we looked at, as I was preparing for the interview, I looked at two X-Files episodes which you wrote and directed. And when the first one popped up, you know, I hadn't seen an X-Files episode in a long time, but I actually remembered this one. I mean, it really stuck in my head. And it's one, it's about a baseball player in the Negro Leagues in New Mexico in the 40s who could easily be a big league player but always avoided playing well before scouts because it turns out he's actually an alien who's come to Earth as part of a plan of conquest but fell in love with the game of baseball and went native and became a ball player because he loved the game of baseball. Where did that story come from?
It was 98 when McGuire and Sosa were having their home run race?
Uh-huh.
And baseball was on everybody's mind, and there was a there was an article in the New York or the LA Times about a minor leaguer, and I can't remember his name, but he hit more home runs than anybody. He hit 70-some home runs for the Nevada something or others. So I thought, well, here's a guy in the desert near Area 51 who's hitting all these homers, and he's unknown. And I just started to kind of meditate on that idea. And then, you know, also... Roswell happened the same year that Jackie Robinson went to the bigs. So I thought that was an interesting coincidence to try to play with. And everything started to fall into place from there. And I liked playing with the ideas of aliens and alienation from society. And I thought it all kind of worked and came together thematically. And then the plot came.
Yeah, no, and it worked well because there's actually an alien bounty hunter trying to track him down and bring him in for having deserted his kind. But I want to listen to a little piece of a clip of that episode. This is early on when you, Agent Mulder, are with Agent Scully, and you're going over records from newspapers in New Mexico, and she notices that you've actually been looking at some baseball scores. Let's listen.
Mulder, you cheat! I can't believe it. You've been reading about baseball this whole time.
I'm reading the box scores, Scully. You'd like it. It's like the Pythagorean theorem for jocks. It distills all the chaos and action of any game in the history of all baseball games into one tiny, perfect, rectangular sequence of numbers. I can look at this box, and I can recreate exactly what happened on some sunny summer day back in 1947. It's like the numbers talk to me. They comfort me. They tell me that even though lots of things can change, some things do remain the same. It's
boring. Mulder, can I ask you a personal question?
Of course not.
Did your mother ever tell you to go outside and play?
That's a nice little piece of dialogue. Do you remember that? Do you remember where it came from?
That came from my heart, really. You know, I love box scores. I look at them. I look at them over and over. Not so much anymore because I don't follow baseball so much, but... there was something about the numbers and the box score and the fact, you know, my wife would say, you know, how do you read that? What are all those little notations and numbers mean? And it's really not that complicated, but it appears to be some kind of mystical, you know, sequence of numbers and letters. And I always felt it.
My guest is David Duchovny. His new film is House of D. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor, writer, and director David Duchovny. He has a new film which he has written and directed. It's called House of D. What did get you out of academia and into Hollywood?
When I was getting my PhD, I always had the sneaking suspicion that I was in the wrong place and that while I could have been, I think, a good teacher, I would always be a mediocre academic, and I wasn't ready at the age of 22 or 23 to resign myself to mediocrity. I wanted to try to find something that I could be better than mediocre at. So I was really that doesn't sound very ambitious, but I was looking for an out. And as I said, I started writing, and if I thought I would write stage plays, I thought I should learn how to speak the words that I was going to write.
And you eventually found yourself in Hollywood and got parts here and there.
Yeah.
And then the X-Files happened, and your life changed.
Yeah, I was, I'm talking to you from the Carnegie Hall building, and I studied acting here many years ago, just a few floors above from where I'm talking to you, and with Robert Modica. So I worked hard when I was in graduate school. By the time I got out to California, I was beginning to understand a little about what I was doing. And I managed to get some pretty interesting film roles, like in The Rapture and in California. But I was really going from film to film, and it was kind of haphazard. And when I did get The X-Files, it really enabled me to act every day. And that's what I really needed to do, because I started when I was 26, and I felt and I knew that I needed experience. I needed to work every day so that I could teach myself my own acting.
That's interesting. I wonder if you can think of an example of something that you found you were able to do in the fifth season that you couldn't do in the first.
Well, you know, it's very much of a trade-off, because when I look back, sometimes I'll be flipping channels with my wife and a show from the first year will be on, and I'll say, just look at how bad I am. Just watch. This is really great how bad I am. And she'll say, yeah, but look at you. You're trying so hard. It's great. You're so committed to trying hard. So I think that even though I became more competent, I think I lost some of that green eagerness that can read really well. There's so many things that go into a performance. Most of the time you're not in control of the best things. Eagerness can go a long way, can seem kind of winning in a character. But, you know, by the time you ask in the third or fourth year, what could I do? I think I was relaxed enough with the process of making a TV show or a film, relaxed enough with a bunch of kind of scientific sounding dialogue, to actually start to relax, to have fun with it, and to bring other things into play rather than just, oh my God, how am I going to survive this scene? Look at all this dialogue.
You know, you were quoted in a Playboy interview a few years back as saying the best actors convey the idea that they never truly get there. I love, this is again what you were quoted as saying, I love when you sense failure in an actor's performance. The best actors have air of failure even at the height of their success. What did you mean by that?
I think I was thinking specifically of Marlon Brando, who has always been one of my favorites, if not my favorite actor. And I think he always had such a kind of... he was always torn, it seemed to me, about the very process of acting. And it kind of read in all his performances, not a disdain, but an ambivalence. And that lent to him an air, to me, an air of sadness or failure around it, that he was reaching for these characters that he could portray so effortlessly and so wonderfully, and yet there was still something that was missing for him. And that was conveyed to me. And I feel like there's always something missing in life and everybody, and that made him human to me, no matter what character he was playing. And when I see a seamless performance, I lose that. I lose the humanity of it.
You've had a series of memorable appearances on a lot of sitcoms. I mean, The Simpsons, and Sex and the City. And there was one that I really loved on The Larry Sanders Show. Where Gary Shandling has the talk show in the HBO series, and you play a guy. You play yourself. You play the celebrity David Duchovny.
Well, I play a character named David Duchovny.
Okay, this character in this case, who has a sexual preference that's, let's say, open to some speculation.
Yes,
and you just do a wonderful job of making Larry Sanders feel uncomfortable. Where'd that come from?
Well, I had done the Larry Sanders Show one time, and through that, Gary Shandling and I became friends. And this was a year later, and he and I were talking, and I said, I'd love to come do the show again. And he said, sure, you know, come up with an idea, and we'll whatever you want to do. If I like it, we'll do it. And I called back sometime later, and I said, I think it would be great if... I had a crush on you, but I'm straight, and I don't understand it. And it's a real crush. I just don't get it. And you're the only guy that I have a crush on. And he said, that does sound funny. Let's try to do that. And they wrote it up, and I just thought, my instinct is always to play it real first and to just, you know, commit to the reality of the desire. So I thought, you know, it's just going to be really funny if you're not winking at all. Don't wink at all. You know, what's funniest is commitment, not winking to me. So I thought, yeah, just caress his cheek and, you know, tell him that you're confused.
Let's hear some of this. This is David Duchovny appearing on the HBO series, The Larry Sanders Show.
Hey, could you give Larry and I just a minute?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
Thanks. You're not upset that I'm taking Carol to the beach, are you?
Don't be silly. Of course not. She's a nice girl.
Oh, good. Well, I'm sorry I'm not going to be on the show with you.
What are you talking about?
No, my agent called, said the network went ballistic, and they put me back on with Jon Stewart.
Damn it. Shit.
No, you're...
They're just not supposed to do that.
You're upset.
Damn it.
God, you're really upset, aren't you? God, you really care about me, don't you? Are you uncomfortable?
A little bit.
Okay. I'll see you.
See you later.
Bye.
Did you see that?
Yeah, next time, kick him in the balls.
That was David Duchovny on The Larry Sanders Show. You know, I have to say, since you have such a reputation as a Hollywood hunk, was it sort of fun to play off that and as a guy who's struggling with his sexual identity?
Well, you see, what I thought was so funny was that I wasn't really struggling with my sexual identity. This was like a one-time offer, you know, and it was only for Larry Sanders. But that's what I found funny about it, was the confusion, the kind of playing with the, playing confused with sexual confusion. You know, and just kind of reducing it, so that's what I was attracted to in that kind of a scenario. But in terms of Hollywood hunk and all that, I mean, I don't care, and I don't ever really think about it. I'm just getting along.
Just a regular guy.
Just getting along. Oh, I was an ugly duckling in high school, all that stuff. No, but I don't know. That just seems like it's on the outside.
Well, you've come a long way from the graduate program of English in Yale. Not only did you come to Hollywood, not only have you been in a hit series, but you are actually married to a beautiful actress. I mean, what a cliche. is it true that you...
Again, just like Hollywood hunk, being a cliche, it just lays on top of me. I don't feel it.
Sometimes it works. is it true that you met your wife, Taya Leone, when you both were auditioning to be on The Tonight Show?
That's when we first met. My manager had told me, you should get on The Tonight Show. And I said, well, why would I do that? And she said, well, it's good. You know, people see you out there and then they think of you. And I said, well, then I'll go. And she said, well, they don't really want you. I said, well, what do you mean? She said, well, you kind of have to, you kind of have to have lunch with them and they'll see that you are intelligent and you can speak and perhaps you can tell a story. And I said, I'm auditioning to go on a talk show. And she said, it'll be worth it. Don't worry. I said, all right, I'll go. And so I showed up in the valley at this restaurant, and I sit down. And now I'm not the only one auditioning for a talk show. There's actually a woman there who's auditioning at the same time. This was brutally shocking to me. I couldn't believe that I'd have to audition for a talk show and next to somebody. And Taya, she was married at the time. And she was charming and smart and completely dominated the conversation. I became morose and withdrawn and was not invited on The Tonight Show, but Taya was.
God, you failed your lunchtime audition.
Yeah.
You directed your wife, Taya Leone, in an X-Files episode. It was Hollywood AD, I think.
Yeah.
I'm wondering if you learned things about working with her that helped her later when she played the role in House of D.
Well, you know, everybody knows that Taya is a brilliant comedian And I kind of used her that way in Hollywood AD. But in House of D, even though I think it's a very funny movie in places, she is not
she's
comedian
not funny.
In this film. And, you know, because I live with her and because I know her, for me, humor is often a key to any character that I play, because I think the way a character is funny says so much about them. And I often think that the way a character is funny hides exactly where their pain is. And with Taya, living with her, I know the pain, you know, that drives the humor. And so it was very, very easy for me to know that she could play this kind of a role.
My guest is David Duchovny. His new film is House of D. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is actor, writer, and director David Duchovny. His new film is House of D. You're working on some other stuff, including, I read, you've written a film set against the Boston Red Sox 1978 pennant race collapse?
Yeah. That's called Bucky Effing Dent.
Okay.
Bucky Freaking Dent.
Okay.
It's what all the Boston Red Sox fans refer to Bucky Dent as. He's known throughout New England as Bucky Dent.
Uh-huh.
And I just thought it was a great title for a film. And it is set in 78, and it's really a father-son piece using that collapse and as a backdrop.
And we should mention for our audience that doesn't know that Bucky Dent was singles-hitting shortstop who slew the Boston Red Sox with a pop-up wind-driven home run in Fenway in a playoff
well,
game in 1978.
Red Sox fans will say the bat was corked. But in the movie, Bucky Dent is used as a kind of a metaphor for the little guy that beats you, that comes up from behind in life and beats you. It's not the Mickey Mantles and the Reggie Jacksons, because you can see them coming, but it's always Bucky Dent that ruins your day, and that's kind of the heart of the movie.
Huh. And is it going to be made?
I sure hope so. You know, I'd have to change the title probably.
Yeah, right.
But Bucky Dent's not a bad title.
Yeah.
I think it's the best thing I've ever written, so I hope it gets made. I would like to shoot it either this fall or next fall, because it takes place in September in New York and some in Boston. And I'm just trying to get financing to cast right now.
You write, you're an actor, but you've obviously spent a lot of time writing. When you were in The X-Files, you found time to write some episodes, and you've written screenplays. You have a novel. There's poetry.
Well, a novel.
No?
I mean,
no?
You use that term loosely. It will never see the light of day. It's a collection of words.
Wow, that bad, huh?
Maybe not that bad. There are a couple things that are, you know, there's a couple chapters that are decent. It's got a great title. I'll give it that.
Tell us the title if it's not profane.
No. It's called Wherever There Are Two.
Uh-huh. Has your wife, Taya Leone, read it?
Underwhelming for you, but I like it.
Yeah?
Has my wife, Taya, read it?
Yeah.
I believe she has. I think she has. And she may not have, though. But maybe she has.
Okay. I sense a
How's
discomfort.
That for
an I sense a discomfort
no,
in this
no,
area.
Honestly, there's no discomfort. I honestly can't remember. I mean, I wrote that when I was 21, And I got a very nice rejection letter from Putnam, who said that I would probably have a wonderful first novel in 10 years. So what I did was 10 years later, I sent it to them again. I thought they, oh, great.
Right.
I thought they were saying I was ahead of my time. No, I didn't send it to them again. But, you know, I think it showed promise, but it wasn't structured. You know, I did, in some ways, becoming an actor and being on The X-Files and learning about drama was the best thing that ever happened to my writing, because I was, you know, kind of a modernist.
Uh-huh. So are you going to go back to that novel or no?
No, there's no way. It's like, you know, Henry James used to say in one of his prefaces that he used to rewrite all the time and revise, that it was trying to follow somebody's footprints in a snowstorm. And I'm a different guy. It would be like trying to revise a novel that you wrote, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I think when you're writing, you really have to ride the inspiration in the moment that you have it.
Well, David Duchovny, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Since leaving The X-Files 5 years ago, David Duchovny has appeared in several movies. House of D, which he wrote and directed, premiered this month. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chellog, Sam Brigger, and Joan Tui Westman. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Delta, publisher of Gasa Gasa Girl, a novel of suspense and the Japanese-American experience by Naomi Hirahara, author of The Summer of the Big Bocce. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a look back at the days when radio pitchmen, hoping to avoid federal regulations, built the world's most powerful transmitters just across the border in Mexico, blasting their programs in English back to the U.S. Bill Crawford tells us about Border Radio, which transformed sleepy towns on the Rio Grande and made Wolfman Jack a nighttime sensation. I'm Dave Davies. Join us for the next Fresh Air.